another voyage into awakening to our multidimensional selves on Otherware. Hello, I'm Liz Miller, and I'm coming to you live again this week with a very, very special show, and I'm so glad that you've joined us. I'm broadcasting to you from Melbourne, Australia, via bbsradio.com and the digital internet airwaves. Thank you again for being here. Now, I've got a lot of stuff to get through before we bring on our guest. And before I do that, let me just tell you a little bit about her. Her name is Ellen Hayakawa, and she is a former wildlife biologist with the government in Canada, author of The Inspired Organization, Spirituality and Energy at Work. And she has taken a few leaps of faith to follow a path that ultimately led her to her current work, which includes coaching children with highly developed psychic abilities, or indigo children, or the new children, as they are called, to realize their full potential. In the process, she also supports their parents to understand their own psychic gifts. Her work is about relationship and teaching parents and children how to communicate with each other, sometimes telepathically, and I can't wait to get into that a little bit later. And I'd like to make a very quick announcement right at the beginning of the show that we're going to do a little bit of work on the show this week on awakening our telepathic skills. If you were listening last week, we had a fantastic guest, Colleen Nicholson, came and join us to talk about animal communication, and she broached the subject of telepathy, of course, because that's primarily how you do it. So I thought this week, wouldn't it be fun to actually do an exercise with Ellen, seeing that she is a coach and one of the best in the world, and that will be coming up later. So if you have someone that you can do a telepathic exercise with, either call them or grab their arm and pull them next to you, and get ready for a really excellent show. So get comfortable and let's begin. Now, it's the beginning of the crop circle season up in the Northern Hemisphere, and I know if you're in England, there are already crop circles that have come down, and I thought I'd mention one that happened just at the start of the month. June the 9th was when it was discovered, and it is stunning. It's a new crop circle that was found at the North Farm near West Overton in Wiltshire. It's a glyph that is an arrangement of rings in a cluster spread over approximately 150 feet. And if you happen to listen to the show with Janos, who is a graphic designer from Holland who works with the Arcturian crop circle makers, I kind of had a feeling, if you've seen any of his depictions of the holograms and crop circles that come down in the fields that they are responsible for. When I saw this brand new one, I thought this has got to be another Arcturian design. It's absolutely beautiful, and if you'd like to go check it out, do so at the cropcircleconnector.com website. That's www.cropcircleconnector.com. And Stephen Hawking says humans must go into space. This is a story that was released on the 13th of June from the Associated Press. The survival of the human race depends on its ability to find new homes elsewhere in the universe because there's an increasing risk that a disaster will destroy the Earth, world-renowned scientist Stephen Hawking said Tuesday. The British astrophysicist told a news conference in Hong Kong that humans could have a permanent base on the Moon in 20 years and a colony on Mars in the next 40 years. We won't find anywhere as nice as Earth unless we go to another star system, added Hawking, who arrived to a rock star's welcome Monday. And he had a lecture that was on that was apparently sold out. Now, for those who love chocolate, this is a very funny story that I came across in New Scientist. And apparently chocolate generates electrical power. Can find. Actually, it looks like I've deleted that story. But it's basically about the processing waste from chocolate manufacturers. There's a bacteria that can eat it all up, and basically it converts the energy, or somehow the energy can be converted into usable power for us. So there are plans underway to actually see what the viability would be of being able to use the chocolate that we love and the waste that comes from it to good use. And apparently drinking alcohol every day protects against heart disease in men, but not in women, Danish research shows. So that daily drink, being good for all of us, apparently is only good for men. A study of 50,000 people found that men who drank daily had a 41% reduced risk of coronary heart disease compared with a 7% drop in men who drank once a week. In women, the risk of heart disease fell by a third with a weekly drink, but it didn't fall further in daily drinkers. Experts warned the results published in the British Medical Journal should not be used to justify heavy drinking. Previous research has shown that moderate alcohol intake is associated with a lower risk of heart disease, but up until now, most studies have been in men. So, unfortunately, for all of the ladies out there who like to have a tipple, it's not going to really help you out in terms of your heart health, but it might help you out in other kinds of health, emotional health, possibly. And what else have we got? We've got some wonderful mail. Oh, actually, before we get to the mail, there was one last story I had to mention, and it's about the Red Rain of Kerala story that I reported on around 3 months ago, when reports of a bizarre red cell-like substance fell over certain parts of India, and which has been studied at Mahatma Gandhi University in Delhi, in India, by Dr. Godfrey Lewis. And it could be the first ever discovery of a form of extraterrestrial life. Now, that's pretty much the same story that I reported on earlier this year. However, if you tune in to this week's Dreamland, I'm definitely a big fan of the show hosted by Whitley Strieber, Linda Moulton-Howe, who has a regular reporting segment, interviews Dr. Lewis and gets the lowdown from him about this red rain. Apparently in the lab, as he's collected samples of it, and the rain did fall down a few years ago now, but he managed to capture samples as it came down, and he's been analysing it in the lab, and apparently some of the cells have been dividing. Although there is no DNA structure to any of the cells, they look just like red blood cells, and they are possibly of extraterrestrial origin. And, there was even a peer review article that was published in the Astrophysics and Space Science Journal just recently. So this is being studied quite seriously, and it could be, as I said earlier, the very first discovery of extraterrestrial life. The fact that it's multiplying is slightly worrying. Hopefully it won't be anything too threatening to us. Anyway, last week, as I mentioned, we had Colleen Nicholson on the show and some wonderful mail came in. Let me read out a little bit of it. From Boyan and his dog Din Din, I got an email saying, "Dear Liz, I thoroughly enjoyed the show. You are correct. Sunny's message was so profound that I couldn't imagine anyone not being moved by it. Earlier this week, I noticed that Din Din had been snoring a fair bit, so after visiting Colleen's show, I took it upon myself to have a chat to her, and she told me that she would prefer if I smoked outside. So I found an aquamarine crystal and put it in around her neck in between the collar folds. She's been so happy ever since. I'm hoping that her lung field will clear up soon." And the lady across the road has never really spoken to us, but the other day she virtually ran over to us and started chatting. I think it must have been the crystal. I'm just so delighted that the universe has brought us together to share these experiences. And from Syme, from the Otherwhere Network at yahoogroups.com, another wonderful email from him. He says, "I have this new cat I mentioned, or rather it has me, and wouldn't have anything to do with me, so I dug out my amethyst when I went to bed after the show. Up till then, I had barely gotten anywhere near this cat and wasn't connecting well, so I asked for an open channel to communicate with it, and the next morning it was a whole new ball game. He almost bolted, but he didn't fly out the window like a grey streak like he had any other time I chanced upon him, being a robber of food up to that point. That morning, he sat by the bowl while I dished out breakfast for all of them, and Syme has two other cats, and after he ate, I gave him a brushing and picked out all manner of twigs and burrs out of his half-Persian hair. That was Sunday morning, so you can imagine my pleasure at listening to your show. I had to share the story, no word of a lie. Blessings in the light and the opening you create for it to shine, Liz. Thank you, Simon. Beautiful, beautiful email, and I'm so glad that you finally, got a little bit closer to the cat. And finally, an amazing email came in titled Ode to Zany and Liz, which came from Kelsey, who is also a member of the Otherwhere Network, and I do urge anyone out there who'd like to participate in a more connected way with our network to join up, and I'll give you the address later in the show. And after a preamble that I'm not going to repeat because it's almost too flattering for the air, I'll just read out the final section of his email, which is just amazing. He says, praise the God and Goddess within us. Praise the women and men that work so hard to bring the light of tomorrow to us. Zany, I believe you serve an awesome purpose in healing the oversoul of the male energy, as you are unabashedly yourself. Men are becoming aware of themselves and their ways, and such a tremendous healing is occurring through people like yourself, as you are unafraid to drop the fists and surrender to the person you are. And he was referring to Zany Mystic, who presents on Friday nights here on BBS Radio at 6 p.m, and you must catch his show, A Fireside Chat, and the guests that he's been having on, because they are just outstanding. And Kelsey goes on to say, Liz, as a man, I cannot pretend to understand a woman. That is probably for our own good. When men drop their intellect in the presence of the goddess, it allows men the opportunity to surrender to softer, gentler feelings, reconnect with our feeling nature. I simply love you and bask in your beauty. Once bitter and hardened army soldier, completely melts while listening to you. Thank you to both of you for being so courageous in your endeavours. May we all be so bold to live and serve our purpose. Well, I know that Zany was melted to the core when he read that, and so was I. I really can't say anything else, so thank you so much, Kelsey, for your support, your encouragement, and your beautiful, eloquent words that are a true example of a man who is definitely awake to his inner goddess, most certainly. But you seem to have struck a really fine balance between the goddess and God within, and it's just brilliant to know that you're part of our network. Thank you. Now, let's go into some music. When we come back, we'll be talking to Ellen Hayakawa, voted as one of the great women of the 21st century in the 2006 edition by the American Biographical Institute. But before that, let's have a listen to a brand new remix from Tom Middleton. It's called the Cosmos Remix, so I definitely thought it was perfect for the show. It's of Bar à Tim, which is a track named after a club in Paris, and this is by Kerry Chandler. So, Don, whenever you're ready to hit it, we'll be back in a few minutes. You're listening to Otherwhere on bbsradio.com, and I'm Liz Miller. Push out,
come to life.
Hello everyone, we're back. Apologies for the break and the dead air that you heard, but you were just listening to the Cosmos Mix of Bar-Hatim by Kerry Chandler. And we're back with Ellen Hayakawa. She's on the line and voted as one of the great women of the 21st century. She lives in Vancouver and is a path cutter of immense proportions and, in my opinion, one of the most transformational beings on the planet. Hi, Ellen. Hello. It's it's wonderful to have you on the show.
Hi, Liz. It's wonderful to be here.
Once I get my tongue in the right place, hopefully we'll be able to have a really great chat. You've had a really incredible career. You started off as a wildlife biologist with the Canadian government, and now you're an internationally renowned keynote speaker, a workshop facilitator, a corporate coach on spirituality in the workplace, and you are working now as a coach with some of the Indigo Kids and are planning a summit in 2008 based on these children called the Children and Youth Summit on Spirituality and Sustainability. What an amazing, amazing array of talents that you have and things that you've had you've got under your belt.
Yes, I had an amazing career in the federal government, and I really feel that now I'm doing the work that I was put on the planet to do. So that's been very exciting. And that basically happened about a decade ago when I had a dream and was basically called by spirit in a dream to begin to do the work on spirituality.
Prior to that, had you been what you would call a spiritual person?
I think that I was probably quite unusual as a child, and I always think that life sort of spirals around, and I guess when I was 3 years old, I saw an angel, and apparently I came down in the morning and said, last night I saw an angel. And my family said, well, what did the angel look like? And I said, she was this big. And I sort of drew my hands apart and indicated quite a small angel. And they said to me, well, and what did you do? And I said, well, I looked at the angel and then I went to sleep. what else would you do if you saw an angel? And so I guess by the time I was 5, I wanted to go to church, and I didn't come from a church-going family. There were no, there was no religious writings around me. We didn't, pray at dinner or pray before bed. But I think that I always had a knowing of God, and that at a very young age, the angels would come to me at night and teach me about crystals and healing. And the things that I basically needed to know in my life. So from the time I was 5 to the time I was 15, my parents didn't quite know what to do when I said, when I was 5 years old, I want to go to church now, seeing that they didn't go. But they did call a friend of the family, and he said, oh, I'll bring her to church with my children. So from the age of 5 to the age of 15, I went to church with him and his family.
Wow. So it's definitely been a part of your life since the very beginning, but there was an awakening when you had that dream.
Yes, absolutely. Well, and I guess I'll say, because it's been a very interesting blend, I left at the age of 15 the church. I was quite disillusioned at that point. I thought that I was basically saying, oh, the church is hypocritical. And, at that point, I was basically confusing people and spirit. But I really think I needed to go and just do my own exploration. And by that time, I was quite interested in the environment. I actually started campaigning when I was about 7 years old to save the baby seals, and I would send petitions to my member of parliament, and started working at a non-governmental organization called Pollution Probe, which was at the University of Toronto in Ontario, Canada, when I was probably 12 or 14 years old, and really always have had a deep caring about the earth. And so I guess when I was 15, I went on a conservation education program. It was to develop leaders in conservation and the environmental movement in Canada. And so that, you know, then came a lifelong love of the Canadian wilderness. I went on canoe trips and a really deep interest in nature and biology and how life works. And that's how I became a wildlife biologist. But those questions, the oppositions of science and of spirituality, of course, came to the forefront when I was attending university. It was very obvious that there was a debate, and I remember they brought in two professors who debated creation and evolution as though there could only be one or the other. And it was also very obvious that as a science student, we were really expected to believe in the theory of evolution only, without, you know, being able to acknowledge that that creation might be a part of it and that simply can't be explained. So, and I remember sitting in it was probably first or second year science class, probably in an auditorium of 500 students, and feeling inside of me, why are we having this particular debate? And I believe in both creation and in evolution, as a scientist, and in evolution. And I don't think it needs to be one or the other. And I also knew at that time, I really felt that although we were told, human beings have stopped evolving, we're the highest we can be on the evolutionary scale, that also was ridiculous, because I knew at the time, people would say, well, we only use about 10% of the brain. And I always felt in just some intuitive way that the evolution of humanity would be in terms of the evolution of human consciousness and the evolution in terms of using the various parts of our brain.
So tell me a little bit about the journey that you took after the dream that you had, and how quickly it was able to be manifested in reality. I know that you were giving presentations to the Canadian government pretty quickly after that, weren't you?
Yes, I became a wildlife biologist, and I spent about a decade working in the federal government. But towards the end of that decade, I went through a depression, and I really feel that depression is often inner, feeling an incongruence of the inner and the outer world. So you're feeling something in the inner world, but it's incongruent with the life that you're leading in the outer world. And there definitely was something there for me. It was as though I felt like there was something else for me here to do other than wildlife biology. And, up until that point, I had loved my job, but I was feeling a bit of dullness. And on the night of my 35th birthday, I had a mystical dream, and I didn't know that was what it was at the time. I always seem to experience things and then read about the experience in some way, and I'm able to label it. So I dreamed I was light, and I was inside the light, I was outside the light, and I felt unified with God, with spirit, goddess, with all that there is. And from that particular moment in time, I began to hear an inner voice with, speaking to me. And the voice said, you are to bring the word spirit and spirituality into the consciousness of people in mainstream workplaces. And I said, well, I don't know how to do that. I'm a wildlife biologist. And that voice has always told me, as this voice has sent me on various missions, you don't have to know how, I will show you the way. And so I happened to be enrolled in a in a Master's in Business Administration program at the University of Ottawa in Canada, and I decided that I would write my paper on spirituality in the workplace. Just as the voice had said, you know, you're to bring the word spirit and spirituality into the consciousness of people in mainstream workplaces. So being enrolled in an MBA program was very mainstream. Also working in the federal government was very mainstream, and so I thought, well, I might as well start here. The federal government's about as mainstream as you can possibly get. So I wrote the paper on spirituality in the workplace, and in a whole series of absolute synchronistic moments, which, because I was just starting on a conscious spiritual path, I didn't exactly know what was happening, but I certainly experienced it, and a manager actually headhunted me out of my job as a wildlife biologist, and I said to him, well, my vision is spirituality in the workplace. Presently, you know, we're the Department of the Environment. Our mission is to empower Canadians to make responsible decisions about the environment, and the only area we concentrate on right now is the material plane. But it's only on the spiritual plane that I know, you know, and focusing on that gives people true joy, true love, true happiness. And if we have to continue to expand, then I really believe that that this expansion is going to be on the spiritual plane. It's an expansion of consciousness and hopefully less material consumption, and at its best, living within the cycles or the laws of nature or the spiritual laws, the laws that govern our planet and this cosmos. And so this manager was incredibly open, and he said, well, I think your vision is too big for this place, but I think we can give you a home. And that's what he did. And again, in the way that miracles happen when you follow your spirit, when you do what you're destined to do here on the planet, in unfolding, really, it's the divine plan for light and for peace on this planet. Again, synchronistic events happened, and within a few short months, I was presenting to all the senior managers in the federal Department of the Environment a workshop, and it was a proposal for a workshop on spirituality and sustainability. And so it went to the highest levels of government. I briefed the Assistant Deputy Minister and the Director Generals, and even briefed the Deputy Minister of the Department, and they really wanted to have a look at this idea. And it was at a time when, you know, over the last decade, I've seen incredible progress and acceptance and exploration and curiosity and the whole field of spirituality at work and spirituality in business growing. But a decade ago, it was definitely, at a pioneering stage in North America and certainly in the world. So I delivered a workshop on spirituality at work, and then in fact sat on a steering committee for another government department, which was the Canadian International Development Agency, and they also, and that was in, I guess it was 1995, they had an international conference on spirituality and sustainable development, and I think over 250 people attended that particular conference. And the World Bank also had a conference at that time on spirituality and sustainable development. So that was really what I felt was the movement, the seeding in major systems in the world, including systems of bureaucracy.
Now, Ellen, you are also the president of Spirit Unlimited and the visionary and founder of the Global Peace, Spirituality and Sustainability Summit that was held in Vancouver in 2001, which I believe must have come out of all of that work that you've just been describing. That summit was actually on 4 days after 9/11, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
Would you tell us a little bit about how things were at that time for you and how all of the people who were involved in the summit reacted?
Absolutely. The vision for that particular summit came after I had given a keynote at a conference in Boston, and I was flying in a plane to New Mexico. I was establishing an environmental program called the Natural Step, helping to establish that in Canada. And I had a vision, and it said Ellen and team to bring together 2001 leaders in business, politics, science, government, health, education, the arts, and all the leaders from all the major spiritual traditions from around the world. And I didn't quite know at that time, you know, when it would be. I knew it was 2000 or 2001, but it became evident that it was 2001. And we booked the dates, September 15th to the 22nd, 2001, about probably 2 or 3 years before that summit occurred. And I was given the guidance that this was a part of the divine plan for peace and an anchoring of the energy. And I went for an astrological reading at the beginning of that particular year. And my astrologer actually said to me, you know, there's a great probability of incredible conflict in the world, you know, this year. And she talked about that period of time in September just because of the planetary alignments. And she said, and if a group of people stand for peace in the world, there will be global peace. And I thought at that time she might be speaking about this Global Peace Summit, and not only this summit, but other gatherings all over the world of people who are standing in light and the truth of peace and what peace is, and trying to live it, you know, in our lives from that that deep place of inner truth and bringing it to the outer material world. And on September 11th, my friends called me. I didn't have a television at the time. And they called me and they said something incredibly tragic is happening in the world at this time in New York City, and you may want to have a look at it. And I turned my computer on and I saw the pictures of the planes crashing into the Twin Towers in New York City. And I knew that all this incredible work that so many people had been doing from the place of their soul's calling on the 2001 summit on spirituality and sustainability, because many, many people put hundreds, if not thousands, of hours of work into this Global Peace Summit. And I knew that all of our work was totally to stand for peace. And so because of the shock of the time and people not, you know, just feeling at a loss, in fact, the summit appeared on the front page of the news section in Vancouver as a place in terms of the an alternative to what happened in New York, a place where we could put positive energy and direct our energy towards creating a global world of peace. So I really feel, and it was amazing, there was a Maori elder who came from New Zealand, and he, I mean, his flights were delayed, but you know, he made it to the summit. And at one of the final events in the summit, we were trying to actually break the Guinness Book of World Records for a drumming event. And we didn't quite break the Guinness Book of World Records, but we certainly had, you know, Indigenous peoples from all over the west coast of Canada and from the interior came to the drumming event. And it was certainly, there were all races, religions, diversity of age, all represented at that particular drumming event, and we were all drumming for peace in the Plaza of Nations in downtown Vancouver. And I'm actually hoping that we're going to be able to break that Guinness Book of World Records at the 2008 Children and Youth Summit on Spirituality and Sustainability.
Well, with all of their energy, I don't think that's going to be hard. And I don't think you'll have a shortage of helpers either.
I don't think so either.
Now, that's just amazing. It certainly would have been such a time of contrast for you, you know, to be right in the midst of all of this tragedy and trying so hard to keep your own balance in amongst it all, and then pulling together a summit that was actually focused on spirituality and peace. I commend you, you know, so highly on your work, and I just I can only imagine what it must have felt like to see that front page and to think, well, at least I've cut out a little chink, you know, out of that horrible just mass blanketing of media coverage on tragedy. At least there was one point of difference in amongst it all that you were responsible for.
Well, you know what? There's a little story about that as well, which is an interesting thing about where our society is and where media is. And I'm just so thrilled that you do this internet radio show because, in fact, the page said, and of course, I was extremely upset about it because I had spent 4 years of my life working on this summit and inviting people, if it was their soul's calling, to basically come and, you know, put their piece of the dream into building this global summit and this global network for peace. And I had said, you know, please work on this summit in a state of love, that we're really, really creating a vibration and a container of love for all those people who are physically present at the summit and all those who aren't here but who are here in spirit. And the front page of the newspaper, because the headlines, of course, are not necessarily put on by the person that reports the event, actually said, "Summit Spirituality Summit focuses on hatred."
Oh. Wow.
And I thought, you know what, this is kind of, I was upset. I phoned the newspaper because it was totally the opposite, in fact, of what
yeah.
we were focusing on. But, you know, I had to let it go. And I had to say, well, whatever's meant to be there is actually there. But maybe this reflects the state of our consciousness and the state of consciousness in the media, you know, at this time.
Absolutely. You've written a book called The Inspired Organization, and I think it's opened up enormous possibilities for people to build a new co-creative vision of being at work again. And, you know, I'd love to address the difference between our work and our jobs.
Yes.
Would you expand on that?
Yes, our work and our jobs. You know, the word vocare comes from the Latin word, or the word vocation comes from the Latin word vocare, which means calling, to call. And a job, to me, you know, and I think we all have different definitions of this, but a job often is something we go and we work at, and we work at it for money, security. Hopefully it fulfills some part of our soul. But a vocation, a calling, is a calling to our life's purpose. And I have a belief that every person was basically created to fulfill a purpose in life. And when you discover that particular purpose inside of yourself and you fulfill it in the world, then your soul is basically fulfilled. It's extremely challenging, and at the same time, it's deeply rewarding. And it's my hope and my dream that we evolve and that we, and I believe that we can all fulfill our purpose, that we don't have to work at just a job and leave our souls and our spirits at the door of the workplace, that when we come to the workplace, we are made up of mind, body, spirit, and emotion. And we bring those through the door every day. And it's the fulfillment of all of those and the fulfillment of our full potential as human and divine beings that's, you know, that's the ultimate. And that's really, that's what we're meant to do, to be all of who we're meant to be.
Sorry, keep going.
Yes, to be all of who we're meant to be in spirit.
The wonderful thing about this book, which is The Inspired Organization, Spirituality and Energy at Work, is that it combines a lot of heart with a lot of practical, usable ideas. And I suppose that this information must have come through the work that you're doing in the corporate world with coaching business people.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes,
what are the main... sorts of statements that you hear from a lot of the people that you're coaching who maybe are feeling as though they have got a calling, but they don't think that they're in the place where their calling is, and they don't really know how to change it and get into that place where they can find out what they're truly passionate about?
Many people come to me at a point where they're feeling the incongruence. So inwardly they know that there's something that they're meant to do. Outwardly they're not necessarily doing it. But there's a desire. There's a desire to do that inner and outer transformation so that the inner becomes aligned with the outer. And when that happens, of course, what always comes up are fears. And there are fears and our blocks and our reasons why we can't do that. You know, we can't leave a secure job. I can't do this because I won't have benefits. Maybe I won't be making as much money. Generally, a financial question comes up. And, I mean, there are all kinds of reasons that we can sort of look on in the outer world and say, well, you know, I can't make that transition. But what I really believe that life is about and what the spiritual journey is about is growing faith. And so in terms of stepping out or stepping into your life purpose, you know, there's a step that you have to take that nobody else can take for you. And it's that courageous step of being able to take whatever that step is. And the fact is it's the person who knows. You know, people know what those steps are. My job as a coach is basically to help them to draw that information out of themselves and to hold the space for them to do it and to encourage them and cheer them on. And as you take the steps, you do see that the universe or spirit gives you feedback to say that, you know, you're on the right course, you're going in the right direction. And what most people find is that their journey, their inward and their outer journey, speeds up. And they do feel an energy, almost like a wave, you know, carrying them along. And it's not to say that they're not going to face challenges to accomplishing and fulfilling their life purpose and their sacred vision of work. But, you know, certainly that they have all the equipment, all the tools, all the skills and the abilities and all the natural gifts to actually accomplish that. And it's really only through walking over that, you know, doorway and generally pushing ourselves a little bit that we get to explore all of those areas of ourselves that we actually don't really know very much about. And it's amazing what kind of gifts we do have and the potential that we do have that we may have an inkling of. But until we actually are doing something in the outer world, and there are mirrors provided to us by our experience and by our actions and by what we create and build, we aren't going to know what those are.
You know the word mission. It's a really highly charged word for light workers, I think, in particular, because so many, and I know so many of the people who are listening to this show, are in the situation where they feel very strongly impulsed to find a way to incorporate their spiritual beliefs and whatever skills they may have picked up, you know, in terms of psychic abilities or healing abilities, etc., to bring them an income. And they find that it's difficult to do that because there's a belief that is held by a lot of people and a lot of artists in generally as well that, you know, that is about poverty consciousness and about there being real merit in not being able to earn a very high income from your art and that you should earn that money elsewhere because your art is sacred or your spiritual work is sacred and you shouldn't really be charging for it anyway. What do you think about that?
You know, we all have very different destinies and we all actually have very different lessons in our journey to total compassion and developing self-love and love for others. And I believe, and you know, there are many lessons about, you know, money is a form of energy. So there are many lessons about money and let's just say resources, you know, so the resources to support us in our vision. And if you need to learn those lessons, and some of those lessons, you know, are difficult, some of them are hard. If you need to develop a compassion for poverty, for example, then the best way of developing it is to be poor at one stage or other. You know, that's the fastest way to being able to develop compassion for that particular situation. And so what I do know is that we're always given exactly what we need. It may not be what we want, because we often want things from our ego self, but we're given exactly what we need. And I certainly have felt, and I do separate sort of mission or purpose and vision of work, because what I say is your life purpose or your mission in life actually never changes. It's a one sentence statement that when you look at every theme in your entire life, it actually fits into fulfilling your mission or purpose. You know, whether that might be global peace, or that might be bringing joy, or that might be, you know, helping yourself and others to fulfill their full potential. It really boils down to one line. Your sacred vision of work does change. I know for me, at one point I was a wildlife biologist. You know, then I changed and I focused on spirituality at work, and then that expanded into working with children in terms of their spiritual wisdom, and under that umbrella, their psychic and intuitive and healing abilities. And I can guarantee that you are given what you need, the financial and the resources of emotional support and spiritual support. And again, you may go through some quite challenging lessons, but you know, once you've learned your lessons, you don't generally have to do them again. And because it's about evolution, in some ways, to me, it always feels, for me personally, it sometimes feels like I'm in the same place, because the challenges are just as big. So it's all relative. And at the same time, as you develop a base of faith and you continue to make decisions based on your guidance and the messages that are sent to you, you become more confident in terms of staying, you know, to continue in every moment to find your own truth in that and walk that particular truth and see that when you stand in that, that you are supported.
We're going to do something quite fun during the show that I thought we should mention right now, because we're going to go to a quick break and then come back and have a talk about the work that you're doing with the kids and the summit that you planned for 2008. Let's talk a little bit about which energy center in our bodies needs to be activated the most if you want to have a clear vision of your sacred mission here on Earth, or you know, generally just how to navigate around in a clearer way, because we're going to be working on that center and doing a clearing exercise. Would you like to talk about that a little bit, Ellen?
Absolutely. So what I want to say is that all of the energy centers, all of the chakras in the body are important, really. And so you know, it's like I don't want to emphasize in some way one above the other, because to me they're all equal and we need them in balance in order to basically receive and ground and anchor vision. That's, you know, basically what it is. But in terms of a lot of the work and the work that I'll be speaking about tonight and the work with the children, a focus is on the third eye, which is in the center of our forehead. In this placement, just sort of above our eyes in the center of our forehead. And that really is a place of, a center of consciousness, of spiritual insight, of intuition, a place where we can basically, you know, if we focus on that particular place, we can tune into energies. So that's it. That is what we'll be talking about tonight.
Great. And we're going to give people an exercise in telepathic skills.
Yeah.
Or honing their telepathic skills. That'll be fun.
Yes.
Have you got anything in mind?
I do. So what I had in mind for the break is that if you're listening, that you pair up with someone else. And so hopefully it would be fun to do it. If you have a child listening with you, it would be fun to pair up with your child. Or, you know, if you have a child friend over at your house tonight or this morning or wherever you're listening in the world, whatever time it is, to pair up with them. Or you could also phone someone and do this exercise with them if you happen to be listening by yourself. And the exercise would be for one of the partners to send a number or a color. So let's say numbers between 1 to 20 or colors to your partner. And the person that's sending could actually, if they want, write the number or the color down and then focus and send that number or color to the other partner. And you may want to tell, in terms of your partners, you may want to say, I'm sending numbers, or I'm sending colors, or you know, if you want to be really daring, you could send, well, I may send you a number or a color. And then have the other person tune in with a third eye and identify what color or number that they're receiving. And then you can...
Fabulous. And later in the show, in the second hour, well, actually, we've just gone into the second hour, but towards the end of the show, we're going to ask you to call in with your results. So those numbers are 1-877-876-5227, that's toll-free, or 530-876-3222, and that's area code 1 for the US. Once again, that toll-free number is 1-877-876-5227. And when we come back, we'll also be bringing a friend of mine from Melbourne, Caitlin, onto the line, as Caitlin is somebody who has been featured in a documentary about people who have synesthesia. And I know that synesthesia must be something that you've encountered many times in your travels with the kids, Ellen.
Yes,
would
I
you
have.
Tell the audience a little bit about that?
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, I have to say that I was my first encounter with synesthesia was I was listening to a radio program about 2 days before I was going to do a workshop on discovering your psychic and intuitive abilities. And this workshop that I do is with families. So I often do workshops with 3 generations. I haven't yet had 4 generations come to a workshop, but I'm looking forward to that day. And I happened to be listening to the radio, the CBC in Canada, and they had a program on synesthesia. And my ears perked up, and I thought, you know what, this has something to do with this workshop that I'm going to be delivering this particular weekend, that I'm going to be facilitating. And I would actually like to read you a piece. This is a piece by a 9-year-old child who attended that workshop. Her name is Cheyenne, and I often ask children to basically share their experiences and to write a piece. I have a newsletter, and so there's a section in the newsletter called Children Sharing with Children. And, of course, you know, she's also sharing with adults, but kind of nice to have children speaking to other children around the world. And so here's what Cheyenne says. She says, "We can smell more than food and flowers." So it's by Cheyenne. Here she says, "I am 9 years old. In February, I learned some things for the first time that I can do. First, I discovered I could smell colors while blindfolded. Then I discovered I could smell individual letters, and finally, whole words and sentences if the letters are large ones. Every letter smells differently, but W and M smell almost the same, so I mix them up sometimes. If the letter is colored, it smells more like the color than the letter. The smell just comes into my mind. Some words are easier than others to smell, and shorter words are easier to smell than long ones. When I am blindfolded, I can tell where there is large or small print on a magazine. I was amazed when I first realized I could do this. In fact, I'm still amazed. Lately, I've been feeling letters more than smelling them. I play these games with friends now to see if they can do this too. I have since learned that I can direct healing energy towards a cut and stop the pain. I now want to learn how to do more. I now want to learn how to do more things, especially how to walk through a wall. So that's from Cheyenne. And synesthesia is a very common, there are many people who have synesthesia. And a lot of times it's expressed as I see colors when I hear certain notes played in music. And the colors are consistent with the notes that are being played. And in the CBC interview that I was listening to, there was a research paper, a scientific paper that was coming out. I think it was in the journal Nature. And the paper was out of the University of Zurich. And they're doing research on synesthesia. And this happened to be a case study of a woman who, when she would listen to music, she would basically taste the music. So it's almost like a crossover of the senses. And it was interesting in this Cheyenne, when we're in the workshop, when I did see her smelling the colors, and then one of the words that she smelled was actually peppermint. And there was something interesting because at the beginning of the workshop, I had people draw cards, and it was from a tarot deck. And she actually drew a card that stated logic. And I said to myself, well, I wonder how logic is going to play into her day and the day, of all of the people in this room, because it generally means that that energy is also applicable to the group. And so I saw her smelling this word, peppermint, and when she smelled the word on the magazine, so she was blindfolded, she smelled the word, and she said, and I would say it was at this pace, she said, peppermint. And so afterwards we do a debrief on the exercise and just to see what everybody's experienced during the exercise. And so when I said, so how did you get the word pepper? Peppermint, rather. And she said, well, I smell pepper. And I said, oh, well, what kind of pepper? And she said, well, I smelled red pepper. And so I said, oh, and how did you get the word mint? And of course, my assumptions, I try not to assume anything. I try to be a blank slate. But my own preconceived idea was that she had actually smelled peppermint. Yes. I'd seen her, when I'd seen her smelling the magazine, that she'd smelled peppermint. But no, she'd smelled pepper, and she said, I smelled red pepper, so that's how I got the word pepper. And I said, so, and how did you get the word mint? And she said, I smelled green. And she said, and I said to myself, pepper green? And I said, no, that doesn't make sense. It must be peppermint. So there was logical deduction.
They're such lateral thinkers, though.
In her day, yes, but the rapidity at which it came out that she made it was just, she smelled the word. I saw her. She felt, and she said, peppermint. It was that fast.
Well, it's going to be fun to bring Caitlin on the phone, and we'll do that when we come back after the break. And we'll also go through a clearing exercise for the sixth chakra, the third eye, and the telepathic chakras that are smaller, that are located around the eyes, the temples, and just behind the ears. And that'll be coming up after we return from having a listen to Joy Cardwell singing with Blaze, with the Underground Dance Artists for Life. This is a release on King Street out of New York. It's called Be Yourself. And we'll be back with Ellen Hayakawa just after that. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
Hello, and we're back. And you've just been listening to Not Be Yourself, but Slow Movements in the Night. And yes, we are having very slow movements in the night around here, but we have got everything happening again. That was P60, a new release on King Street. It's not out till July the 3rd, and definitely a hot track, that one. Now, we've got Caitlin Darrick on the phone. She's calling from Melbourne, Australia. And Caitlin, welcome to Otherwear.
Thank you. Hi, Liz.
Hi. It's so wonderful to have you on the show.
No problem.
We've just been speaking to my guest, Ellen Hayakawa, today about one of the people that she's been coaching, a young girl called Cheyenne, who has synesthesia. She has a slightly different synesthesia to you in that she will actually be able to smell words and she can do it when she's blindfolded. You've got a different version of synesthesia. Would you please tell us about your own abilities?
Yeah, sure. Well, I've got what's called lexical colour synesthesia, which means I perceive words, words and numbers as having colours, words, letters and numbers as having colours. And also some music gives me patterns and colours as well, but only certain types. But, so whenever, like, you know, you say, what colour is the word horse, or, you know, what colour is the word plant, you know, I get, the word horse to me is red. A lot of people with the same type of synesthesia will maybe say it's blue, you know, they're all very different for everyone.
Yeah. And have you been able to work out for yourself what's happening in your brain when you're seeing these colours?
Yeah, well, I actually did some research with Melbourne Uni about synesthesia, and basically what's happening in the brain. I had a brain scan, and the part of the brain that is, you know, working with words and colours accessing like different parts, so it's cross senses, cross union of the senses, and different in the actual brain scans, the colours would show up, you know, much better, much more predominantly than in a non-synesthete in there. So, I guess what's going on is like a union of the senses, basically. Yeah.
Tell me a little bit more about that documentary that you were a part of. Who produced it?
It was Kiralee Brentnell. It was a documentary called My Green Friday, and she interviewed three of us. Two other people. There's one guy who actually had a type of synesthesia with sound, kind of like my one, but he was saying something interesting, which was when he was little and he was in primary school, the bell would ring to go into class, and he thought it was quite unfair because the sound of the bell was pink to him, and he thought that's not very fair for the boys, you know, and something like that. Yeah, and also tasting things like chicken had points or triangles for him, and he didn't like the because of that, yeah.
So have you ever been able to taste shapes or anything else like that?
I haven't been able to taste shapes, but it's mainly with the words, the numbers and the letters, and as I said, like a little bit with music, like certain classical pieces and like sort of electronica gives a lot of kind of almost kind of computerized, you know, sort of graphic images, you know.
What would you see when you'd be listening to classical music?
Sometimes it's like kind of like spirals, or, you know, depending on what kind of instrument it is, I guess, like different colours and kind of, sometimes squares or circles or, you know, something like that. It's quite hard to explain, like, just in talking.
Yeah,
I've tried to kind of, like, draw it sometimes, but even that's sort of hard to kind of get it onto paper. Yeah.
It would be. And is there any times when it doesn't happen?
There are certain words that, people, you know, said, oh, you know, what colour is this word? And I have to say, like, to be honest, I can't actually, I'm seeing a colour, but sometimes there's colours that I can't actually, you know, describe. They're completely off the scale sometimes. So, and yeah, sometimes it's difficult like that. And other words, actually, maybe there's 2% of the time that I can't actually get a colour at all for any of them. So that's very rare.
Hmm.
Yeah.
I was wondering, is Ellen on the line?
I am.
Oh, Ellen, hello. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
What have you been thinking about this conversation I've been having with Caitlin?
Oh, it's very interesting and in line with what I've observed with, and I will say again, it's not only children who have psychic intuitive and healing.
I'm having a lot of trouble hearing you, Ellen.
It's not just children who have psychic intuitive and healing abilities, but also adults. And so that's quite in line. I know that when, for example, people are reading books and magazines and newspapers blindfolded, for example, the first little girl that I worked with, who was, I think, 7 years old at the time, when I asked her the question, how do you read books and magazines and newspapers without your eyes, you know, while you're blindfolded, she said, I focus on it with my third eye and I read the screens inside my head. And that seems to be a fairly common answer among the children. You know, when I ask that question, they'll say, I read the screens inside my head. Or they'll say, you know, you read it with your eye. And when I say, what eye? They'll point to the middle of their forehead or my forehead and say, you know, that eye.
Ellen, I'm not sure if you can hear me, but I'm having a lot of trouble hearing you, unfortunately. But Caitlin, are you still there?
I'm still here, yes.
Oh, good, wonderful. Sorry if we're speaking over you. Caitlin, I might just finish off our conversation so we can swap phone lines again so I can hear Ellen again. But before I let you go, how old are you?
I'm 22, yeah. So I've, I think I've had synesthesia all my life, but it was only when I was about 15 or 16 that I actually realised I had it. And how a lot of synesthetes find out just through realizing, like, just through conversation with other people who don't have it, you know, oh, actually, this might not be as normal as I thought, you know. That's how, yeah. So,
actually, do you know what the statistics are for people with synesthesia?
They used to think it was 1 in 20,000, but now they've actually said maybe 1 in 2,000 people. And
wow.
Who knows, like, you know, there could be even more people who haven't realized yet, you know, and that, you know, they'll find out.
Well, and this ties into, you know, different waves of types of people who have been born onto the planet. I'm sure that there are more people now who have synesthesia than there may have been born, say, 100 years ago. And
yeah,
what has it been like for you to interact with people who are older who have this condition?
I've met a few people older with the condition, and you know, they're in their sort of the 30s to 40s, and I've actually, you know, I've heard of like when I did the research with Melbourne Uni, the girl who's doing her PhD on it, she was saying that a lot of people that she wanted to interview about it and do research on were in their 60s or 70s, but you know, they had it, but they didn't want to talk about it because, you know, when they were children, you know, it wasn't something they could talk about at all, you know, and I think it's a lot easier nowadays, you know, for people my age to be able to say, hey, look, you know, I've got this, sort of, you know, thing in my head, that, you know, and talk about it, and that, you know, and then more and more people, you know, find it a lot easier, I think, yeah. But yeah, these ladies who she wanted to interview, you know, they found it really hard because their parents, you know, told them to be quiet. You know, it's not something that, you know, they should be, you know, talking about in public.
And when you hear a person's name, does it make a difference if you hear just their first name or if you hear both of their names?
It's the actual, like, you know, the actual individual word. So, if the surname will also have a different colour with it, so it doesn't combine. Yeah.
Oh, right. So that's really interesting. So could you tell me what the colour is for otherwear?
Sort of like a white with a little bit of brown in it. A lot of words actually with O starting with O are white for me. So yeah.
Wow. And what about Ellen Hayakawa?
Ellen is sort of a bluey grey colour, and so what was the last Hayakawa?
Hayakawa.
Yeah. That would be red actually for me. Yeah.
Hmm.
Of course,
I'm going to have to ask you mine.
Yeah.
What's Liz Miller?
Liz is white, and Miller is dark blue, like a navy blue, actually. Yeah.
Fabulous. Well, thank you so much, Caitlin. It's been such a pleasure to talk to you.
Great.
And thank
you
for sharing. Good luck with everything.
Thank you.
And take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Hello, Ellen.
Hello.
I'm not sure whether I'm going to be able to keep you on this line. We might have to change lines. Well, that was fabulous. I was so glad to find out what your colours were.
Yes, that was interesting.
Have you got any more stories about the kids that you'd like to share that you've been working with?
Well, I would like to share something about... There's a beautiful piece of writing that a nine-year-old did, and I just want to share her vision for peace and her vision of the world. Her name is Katie DeSante, and she wrote this when she was 9 years old, and she says, "When my mind goes wandering, the wind is blowing, my breath and soul catch the wind currents, and I fly to eternity. I do not breathe from my body. I breathe from the whales that dive deep into the ocean and uncover the deepest thoughts of the mind and soul. But the wind has more to show me, and it lifts me from the water and from the creatures I have encountered. It takes me to a tree that holds a spirit, the spirit of the universe, who sits high on a branch and holds a pebble of her hope. She talks to me. She tells me of the sky and fairies that live among the clouds to the unearthly reaches of the hidden mind. The wind takes me away from the kind spirit and takes me to an eagle that teaches me of the love and kindness of the living human. But then I fall, falling into the deepest depths of the earth. I find nothing but blackness in the earth. Then one star appears, then another and another, until the blackness is no longer there. Instead, I am surrounded by stars and light. That light makes me happy, and it calls the wind to me, and I am no longer frightened, for we are rising from earth to sky, and then from blackness to light, and from light to peace. The wind now takes me to a cave where a wolf is sleeping. The wolf awakes and guides me to the deepest part of the forest where I meet earth and the footpath of my heart." So that's by Katie DeSante, who actually lives on the island where I live, called Bowen Island, near Vancouver in British Columbia, Canada. And she wrote that when she was 9 years old, and she definitely expresses very much the spiritual wisdom that seems to just be inherent in many of the children with whom I've worked and many of the children who are here on the planet at this time. And I think that they're really bringing messages and visions of hope that will actually help us to achieve global peace on this planet, you know, if not in our lifetimes and certainly in their lifetimes. Thank you.
Otherwear.com.
Hello, everybody, and we're back. You're listening to Otherwear. My name's Liz Miller, and we're speaking to our guest, our very, very special guest this week, Ellen Hayakawa. Welcome back to the show, Ellen.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for sharing Katie's poem. That was absolutely beautiful.
You're welcome.
It's so great to hear the kids speaking. You know, a lot of the time we hear about the children through books, or we see movies or documentaries, or if we're lucky enough to have someone who works directly with them like yourself, we can speak to people like you. But it's just so much fun to hear them speak, and to see their faces when they're expressing themselves. It must be such a privilege for you.
Oh, it's just a wonderful privilege and an honor to be able to work with the children and to just witness their light and their unfoldment and, you know, the great spiritual wisdom that they bring. And I believe that with spiritual wisdom come some of those tools which are enhanced psychic and intuitive abilities. And just a couple of weeks ago, there was a workshop, and a wonderful six-year-old boy, you know, talked about how he could see inside people's bodies and how he practices this, and he demonstrated it, and, you know, he went around the circle and he read everybody's aura. You know, it's just like toothpaste and eating for them. And when they talk about the third eye, and, you know, I realized that very early on, that when I said, you know, and how are you reading books and magazines and newspapers, and they'd say, you know, with your eye, and they would point to my third eye, that it was as obvious to them, you know, as our eyes are to most of us, for example, as adults, that it was so visible, so that they could actually, that their brains were in a brainwave state such that they could see in a, that they can see into other dimensions, and they can see into other realities, and they're able to see inside bodies and see people's auras and see angels and fairies and elves. And, you know, they describe all of these things to me, and some of them say, you know, I can read minds. And then sure enough, when we do the telepathic exercises, you know, they're both receiving and sending numbers very clearly, whether it's to their parents or to another child. So, yeah, it's just wonderful to be able to work with them and to hear some of their stories and you know, also their challenges.
You know what struck me the most when you were talking about your early childhood, especially your teenage years, was that it was really obvious to me that you were a typical indigo kid yourself. And you didn't have the good fortune, like some of the kids that you're working with now, to have somebody else out there hold up a mirror to you like you do for these kids. Is that one of the reasons why you're in the work that you're doing now, do you think?
Absolutely. I, you know, when I kind of contemplated my own life journey, I realized, yes, you know, I was being brought full circle, and I'd had certain experiences, and you know, I was highly sensitive as a child, and still am. And you know, I think this path, in terms of the spiritual path, we grow in sensitivity to feelings and to just being able to tune in. I think that's the way that we can actually tune into our own spirit. And if you believe in God, spirit, God, you know, goddess, the universe, that's actually the way we tune into that kind of energy that really guides us. And I am very sure that one of the reasons that I've been called to basically help these children is because I do understand them. Yes, I was one of them. And there are many of us who are adults who, you know, were some of these children. And and as we heard from your friend who, you know, has synesthesia, as she said, oh, you know, people who were in their 70s or older people were told that they shouldn't talk about this. And there's something that, you know, in terms of some of the psychic, intuitive, and healing abilities that we all have, that somehow they were supposed to be underground or undercover, or maybe there was something evil about them. And I think it's really important to be able to bring this discussion, the dialogue, the sharing of the conversation into our society, into our families, into our education systems. We simply don't really talk about these things. So what children are experiencing, they don't necessarily realize that other people are also experiencing that. So we're really just, you know, the work that I do is in terms of normalizing the experience and then helping, you know, by being a mirror. And they have mirrors with other children and other adults as well. But that is the importance of the work that I feel we're developing right now.
You know, there are people who are in their older years who have had a lot of trouble, you know, accepting the fact or having other people believe that they have got these abilities, these extrasensory abilities. But even now, it's still going on. There are, you know, according to some of the latest figures, something like 20 million American children alone who are on Ritalin. And it's coming from the adults who are around these kids, you know, taking them to their doctors because they're hyperactive and they get diagnosed with ADHD or, you know, a myriad of any other types of ailments. And are being completely drugged and misunderstood even now.
Absolutely. There are many of the children who come to see me have been diagnosed with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder or, you know, the myriad disorders. With ADHD, children are put on Ritalin. And, you know, part of what that does is dampen down their energies. And I think that we have to ask ourselves the question, as a society, you know, why is there all of a sudden an epidemic of these so-called disorders and, for example, ADHD? And I would say that many of the children who have ADHD, coincidental or not, are children who can read books and magazines and newspapers without their eyes. So I would suggest that you know, as scientists, and I think that we continue to bridge the world in terms of science and spirituality. I think the bridge is growing and strengthening, but that we really need to look at what's going on with children and their brains and their brainwave states. And it's really important for children to be able to channel their energy. And I would say that these abilities in terms of seeing, feeling, sensing, detecting other dimensions and other realities is actually what's manifesting now. And it's the same with sometimes children come to, are you know, diagnosed with autism, and in fact, when I work with them, I find that they're basically communicating telepathically. And there are other reasons for them that they just, you know, don't want to speak, they're just choosing not to speak. And maybe they're teaching us something in that, they're being a mirror for us because we're using, you know, so many words, and that isn't necessarily the way that information travels, or maybe it's not the most efficient way for information to travel, we'll put it that way. And with drugs like Ritalin, they're methamphetamines, you know, narcotics. We've been giving children apparently Ritalin. There's a medical study done. There's a book by a doctor in Canada, Dr. Michael Lyons, on ADHD. He was diagnosed with ADHD himself, but he talks about that, you know, we've been placing children on Ritalin since actually the 1940s. So by the 1980s, there was 40 years worth of data, and when they looked at the data, it was actually statistically significant that the brains of children, you know, people who are now adults but had been given Ritalin as children, the cortical tissue in their brains had shrunk like the brains of elderly men at the onset of Alzheimer's. And
that's terrible.
Yeah, I just think that, and in terms of some of the doctors, of course, they may not necessarily know about that particular study. They're not necessarily giving parents the information at the time about the possible side effects. And if we look at our adult population, in the Western world anyway, you know, the amount of antidepressants that are being taken, drugs, alcohol, et cetera, you know, we're a society of adults on drugs, giving drugs to our children. And really, you know, we have to look at the root of pain and heal that. And, you know, we all come to Earth. We're incarnated with wounds and with pain. And unless we actually deal with the real wounding and the pains underneath and the reasons that those exist, you know, it seems like an easy way out to drug all of these things, but it really isn't. And I think we're doing a disservice. I think that giving children, changing the brainwave states and the physiology of children is basically, fundamentally an abuse of human rights. And it's my belief that we'll look back at this time and we'll say what, you know, as we evolve in consciousness, and we'll question and ask ourselves, you know, what why were we doing that at this particular point in our evolution? And I very much sympathize and empathize and have compassion, you know, for parents and educators who are at the end of their rope and, you know, really don't know what to do. And when they go to their doctors, you know, they're given advice and they don't know necessarily who or what to turn to. And so, you know, this path of placing their child on drugs, you know, is one path, but I would like us to basically question that very strongly and to also look at the alternative paths that are open. And, you know, there are many alternative paths if you choose to put the energy into exploring them.
We've got to talk a little bit about the summit that's coming up in 2008, because you've got some amazing things planned for that and some wonderful assistance from all corners of the globe. Let's have a chat about what you've got planned.
Well, in 2008, probably in 2000, I knew that this summit, you know, that there would be a series of global peace summits on spirituality and sustainability. But it was about 2000 that I started working with children with spiritual wisdom, and I realized that the next summit, it was very important that the next summit be a summit with children and youth. And so the next summit is the 2008 Children and Youth Summit on Spirituality and Sustainability, and it'll happen in Vancouver, and we haven't got the exact dates yet, but we think it's probably going to be in August of 2008. And at least 50% of the presentations will be given by children and youth, sharing their spiritual wisdom and, under that umbrella, some of their psychic, intuitive, and healing abilities. And we're hoping that also that there will be many adults who are supporting the children to bring their teachings and their presentations to the summit, and who will also present themselves, the work that they're doing in support you know, of children everywhere around the globe in terms of bringing spiritual wisdom to really all sectors of our society. So it's very exciting because we'll be able to listen to the voices of the children and youth and to experience, you know, they're going to help us to experience some things. And what I've been hoping, and the other members of the Co-Creators Council of the summit are hoping, are that children will find their adult mentors, and that adults will find their child or youth mentors, and that it will be a wonderful learning experience for all generations and for all races, cultures, religions, you know, and the diversity of ages. And, you know, I'm encouraging, no matter what age a child is, however young they are, if they want to, if they have something to come and present at the summit, you know, that they do this.
How excellent. I just want to quickly give out the phone number if anyone would like to call. Please do so on 1-877-876-5227, or you can call direct on 1-530-876-3222. That's for the US, of course. And I think it's just wonderful that you've planned this, because, you know, the age of Aquarius and the Aquarian energies are all about, I mean, if you think of the symbol of Aquarius, of the waves, you know, it's like frequencies. And we're all starting to play with the frequencies a little bit more and understand them. And these children are ushering in this, you know, energy that's definitely assisting with that. And one of the other things about the Aquarian energies is the feeling of brotherhood amongst men, you know, of connecting up, building networks. And you can see the outer manifestations already here, such as the internet. And we're now building those wireless networks, the truly wireless networks between people. And I know that for these kids, it's going to be great for them. It'll validate so much of their experiences, especially when they see other kids who have the same abilities or different, you know, so that they don't get into a fear state about what they're able to do or how different they are to everybody else. And it's just going to be able to be a real hub for people to get together from all around the world who are interested in working with these kids or helping them in some way.
Absolutely. The children seem to understand that we're all of one spirit, of one God, Goddess, one universe. And one of the children with whom I worked, Jackson, who was 8 years old, again, you know, he had been diagnosed with ADHD. But one of the things that was interesting about him was at New Year's one time, and I was setting an intention, and I said, my intention is to really consciously work for God. And Jackson replied, in reality, all people work for God, whether they know it or not.
it's just so amazing. They open their mouths and that kind of level of profundity comes out. And some of them are just starting to speak, and they're saying things that deep. It's wild.
That's right. And another young woman with whom I worked, she was 13 years old, and she was labeled as a troubled teen. One day she entered the room and she said to me, the Bible says that the children will inherit the earth.
and there's definitely such great senses of humor.
Yeah, and there definitely is a biblical prophecy. You know, a little child shall lead them. And, you know, that prophecy, this is what's happening at this particular point in time. You know, this is the time of revelations, the time of a great shift from a focus on the material world to a focus on the spiritual world, but with also that consciousness where we don't have to divide and say, you know, one religion is better than another, one spiritual belief is better than another, that I think these children bring that understanding that we're all on very different and unique spiritual paths, and they might come under the umbrella of a religion or not. But that we're really all one in the heart of spirit, in the heart of whatever tradition you come from, and in the heart of humanity, and that we really are all brothers and sisters, you know, in this global family, and that it really is about time that we understand that, you know, on all levels of our beingness, and really open ourselves to that and to that, to the love and the compassion, so that, you know, we don't kill each other and, you know, we're not violent against each other, and that we solve our differences through dialogue and really accept the diversity that is.
There is one point that sort of sparks for me to ask you about, and that is that the kids, as we know, are coming in very, very much awakened souls. But once they're here in the third dimensional earth plane, they're stuck in density and they are governed by the rules and laws of being in the third dimension, and one of those is free will. Let's talk about how you see the children playing with light and dark.
That's a very good question. So many of the children are interested in the darkness, and you know, I think the light and the dark are equally as important. We need to be knowledgeable about that, and we are all of varying degrees of light and dark, and the gold or the treasure is actually in the dark. It's in the shadow. You know, if the place in you is already light, It's not going to help to bring more light there, but it will help to bring light to the shadow or the darkness. In terms of spiritual wisdom, and I think that that's important, that we don't get because, for example, psychic and intuitive and healing abilities can be used, you know, again, we have free will, and so we can use our abilities for what I'll call the light or the shadow. And so that comes down to ethics, and it comes down to awareness and intention and, you know, your willingness and your desire to live in spirit and to do things that are for the highest good for all. And so so I think that the one of the roles that adults can play is that really conscious stewardship or helping children to become aware of, you know, of finding the truth in themselves and being able to make their choices, you know, from that particular place. And many of the children, there's the first little girl with whom I worked who had a wonderful vision when she told me at one point, you know, the most important thing I've ever learned is that I could read books and magazines and newspapers without my eyes. And I asked her, well, you know, why is that? And she said, because I've had a vision since I was 4 or 5 years old. And at the time when I was speaking with her, she was 8. So we first found out she could, and this was a child who said, I focus on the books and magazines and newspapers with my third eye and I read the screens inside my head. She's very able to explain exactly what she's doing. But she said, you know, I've had a vision since I was 4 or 5 years old after my mother read me a story about a blind man who had to lead his horse home through a river. The bridge was washed out. He had to have incredible faith. And by the time that he got home, he had such faith that he could see. But she said, I've always had a vision that I would teach blind children how to ride horses. And now I can teach them that they can ride, that they don't need their eyes to be able to ride horses. So there's a, you know, a child who can connect how her psychic and intuitive abilities combined with this incredible compassion for others will be able to help others. And in fact, this weekend, I was hoping that maybe she would come on this radio program, but she is off at a horse show. So continuing to bring together the skills and abilities that are going to help her to fulfill her dreams. And apparently just a few weeks ago, she's developed a technique called Dark Wave, and it is about working, it's called Dark Induction, and she taught it at a small conference workshop for adults on cancer healing using energy techniques. And apparently she taught it for an hour and a half. So I'm hoping that she'll come and, next year I'm hoping to actually have a camp on Bowen Island for, you know, helping families to develop the spiritual wisdom of you know, of families, and then that includes children, but that she'll come and offer the workshop at the camp and then also at the summit in 2008.
Wow, that's so excellent. She sounds amazing. I'd love to meet her one day. I hope I actually get to meet her at the summit.
I'm sure you will, Liz. along with many other beautiful and loving and compassionate and kind children and youth and adults who are helping to make the world, you know, a better place.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure it's going to be an incredible time. There was something I wanted to ask you about, and it was regarding the Mayan calendar. And it's something that I've been studying now for many years, and I absolutely am obsessed with it because it's just so fascinating. But one of the main messages in the Mount Mayan calendar studies is that when you get in sync with their calendar and you live your life according to their calendar, you realize that it's tracking an evolution in consciousness. And on that tip, I was thinking yesterday about the movies The Matrix and now The X-Men, and how these are two very popular mainstream movies that have ignited the imaginations of especially the younger generations. But a few years ago, when The Matrix was released, it seemed that was all about And the reason why these movies are so huge, I believe, is because they resonate on a very deep level with truths that we all know. Even if they're not consciously sort of thought about, there's still something that we know deep down. And The Matrix, of course, was about, you know, talking about the levels of control and created reality that we're surrounded by, which was something that, you know, 10 years ago, whenever that movie was released, it was something that really was sort of thrusting through our consciousness, or at least in an underground sense. And now it's funny when you look at what people are going to the cinema to see, and it's movies about these children who have supernatural powers or extrasensory powers. And, you know, those are just two examples. I could cite many, many more. But, yeah, have you got any thoughts about, you know, the mainstream sort of consciousness and where they're at with these sorts of ideas and with these realities that are emerging now as the old ones crumbling around us?
Well, I would say Harry Potter is great training for children.
Oh, yeah.
And so, you know, again, writers and the media of our time does reflect our consciousness. And as the Mayans have professed for many, many years, you know, this period of time to 2012 and beyond, is this shift from the material to the spiritual world. And in fact, last January I spent 3 days with Mayan elder Humpetzman in the Yucatan, which is one of my spiritual homes. And in fact, I must say that the 2001 summit was scheduled. Also, I did do Mayan astrology on that, so it was scheduled according to the Mayan calendar.
And, oh, how interesting.
Yeah, and I have lived actually for many years on that timing and following that timing, you know, along with the full and the new moons and the what I call the high celebrations, the solstices and the equinoxes. And, you know, the rhythms of this particular planet and our cosmos. And so,
can I interrupt just for a second? And
yes.
Can I ask you, are you following the traditional Mayan calendar or the dream spell version?
You know what? Right now, for this year, I don't actually have a Mayan calendar. And I know that there's a great debate amongst them, but I don't want to get into the technical details of them because that's not my expertise. And I actually feel that, you know, when you are in sync with spirit, that's actually what's truly important. And the calendar is that outer reflection. So,
yeah.
So in this particular time, I mean, the Mayans actually prophesied it. It's carved on the sides of their pyramids, the head of children and the Kundalini energy basically rising up. And it's through the children. So they prophesied this particular time many, many years ago, and that was something that Elder Humpetzman pointed out to me last year.
Do you know how long ago those glyphs were found?
No, I don't.
Because a lot of the findings that occur with the Mayan artifacts and texts and scripts, etc., seem to be timed. You know, it's like they have these time locks on them, and that at a certain time when all of the frequencies are right, these things just pop out into the world again, and we can access this information. And I would have been really interested to find out how long ago those pictures were discovered. Sorry, keep going.
Yeah, I agree with you, Liz. It's as our evolution in consciousness occurs, we're basically allowed to unfold and to delve deeper and for the what I call the secrets of the universe, or, you know, the way the universe works and the cosmos works, we're basically allowed to really access that information and not till we're ready, and then not till you know, we're ready in terms of humanity as a whole.
We're just over time, Ellen, so I thought I should quickly let people know how they can find you on the internet. Would you like to let them know what your website address is, and let them know also a little bit about the books and where they can be found?
Absolutely. My website address is www.ellenhayakawa.com. So that's ellenhayakawa.com. And the two books, The Inspired Organization, Spirituality and Energy at Work, as well as Healing the Heart of the World, Harnessing the Power of Intention to Change Your Life and Your Planet, can be found at Amazon.com. And I'd welcome also calls from listeners. My office number is 604-947-0622, and you can call or write me about the Peace Summit, and I'll be sending out newsletters, you know, in terms of what's happening, where we are at in terms of organizing and the events.
And what have you got planned for the next 12 months, Ellen?
well, really, the big project is really getting the steering committees, and the co-creators council in the various countries going, so that we can really begin to manifest and anchor the event, and you know, just very practical things about the Peace Summit. I'm working on a sacred mining company, so that's a really quite exciting project, and a book on the experiences and the work that I've been doing for the last 6 years with the children. So a new book, The Divine Plan for Peace, the Children of Peace.
Oh, that's great. Could you tell us a little bit about who's on the steering committee so far for the summit?
Yes, Taj Hamid, who's the Secretary General of the World Association of Non-Governmental Organizations, is on the summit committee, as well as Tobin Hart, who wrote The Secret Spiritual World of Children. He's a professor at the State of West Georgia University. The Secret Spiritual World of Children is a wonderful book for your listeners to read it if they don't know about it. Dr. Mohini Giri from India, who is a Nobel Peace Prize nominee in 2005, is on the summit steering committee, as well as representatives from Romania and the growing body. There's somebody from Trinidad and Tobago. And I was fortunate enough to be in Dharamsala recently, and I spoke with the Dalai Lama's sister, Jetson Pimala, and she's hoping to make it to the summit with some children from the Tibetan Children's Village. There's a 6-year-old Rinpoche apparently living in the Tibetan Children's Village right now. I'm hoping that he will come and teach at the summit as well.
Oh, that'll be amazing. Does he speak any English?
I don't know that. I don't know. children learn English, you know, really right off the bat when they're studying. He'll be 8 by that time, so we'll see. But if not, I'm sure we'll be able to have simultaneous translation.
Fantastic. And I do have to ask you about the Sacred Mining Company. Hallelujah, it's about time.
Yes.
how on earth did you get involved with these people? And it's just fantastic.
Well, part of my job is helping to, I will say, uncover this spirituality, the spiritual laws in the mainstream. So that's my real interest, is that all of this be mainstream, because it has to be. It has to do with our survival on this planet. This planet will go on whether we survive as human beings on it or not. You know, there are people that are being called in the mainstream to really walk very strongly on their spiritual paths and align their businesses, their corporations, their organizations with their spiritual path, and vice versa. And the people around them are also being called to do that. So this happens to be a mining company, Electra Gold Limited, and it's a publicly listed company in Canada, and the management has a wonderful vision of wanting to anchor basically a sacred mining company. And we don't pretend to know what that looks like right now. We know that what we're trying to do is advance it so that we are living within the spiritual laws, so that we're giving back more than, you know, we're taking. And that means community and social sustainability. But, you know, we've been talking about social responsibility for probably the last 20 years. I've been involved in this field for at least, 10 or 15 years of that. And I believe that it's time that the dialogue go to the next level, which is what is sacred responsibility? And that's on a personal level, a collective level, the corporate level. And these are people in a company who are willing to engage at that particular level, which I find really, really exciting.
And before I let you go, I've got one suggestion for the summit. I hope you don't mind me making a suggestion.
Absolutely. We love suggestions.
Well, it has to do with the research that's going on, I believe, right now at UCLA and other institutions, where Indigo Kids and others like them have been studied. Their genome has been studied, and I would love to hear some lectures from some of those researchers.
Great.
Have you thought at all about having some doctors come and make some presentations at all about the children?
Oh, yes. I think it's really important that we do this bridging at the summit of science and spirituality because I have a scientific and mathematical background. I think that this is important that we look at that bridging and what's really going on. In science we study mechanisms and processes, basically. We study them. Again, I don't think we've necessarily created them. They're pretty amazing. And I think that it's important that the summit begin. And again, we're just, beginning a process. There will be other summits. This is going to continue to evolve. And so, this will be the first Children and Youth Summit, and we'll see where it goes from there. But that is an essential part of it.
Excellent. Well, Ellen, it's been such a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so much for your time.
Oh, it's been such a pleasure to speak with you, Liz, and thank you very much for this program.
You've been wonderfully patient. Thank you so much for bearing with us as we've worked our way through some of the technical hiccups.
Thank you.
And before we go, would you like to say anything else to any of the kids who may be listening out there?
Oh, I want to say from, the bottom of my heart that I just really appreciate your beingness and all that you bring to the planet. To your families, to your communities, to your school, to wherever you are at this time in the unfolding, of our lives on this planet. And I just encourage each and every one of you to go out there and really fulfill your full potential and grow and blossom and be supported. To fulfill your full potential. Find those adults who can support you and other children and youth. And I also hope that all of you come to the summit in 2008.
Oh, I'm sure they'll be there.
Yeah.
I'm definitely going to be there, definitely. Yeah. Well, good luck with everything in the future, and I definitely want to have you back on the show with a couple of kids, please.
Great, we'll do that.
All right, we'll do that. Take good care, Ellen. See you later.
Thank you. You too, Liz.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
So, everybody, that was Ellen Hayakawa. Wasn't she wonderful? I'm so glad that we were able to have her on the show, and I'm so glad that you're still with us. We are running over time, so unfortunately we're going to get to that telepathic exercise next week. We're going to spend a proper amount of time on it because if I did it now, we'd be rushed. I'd like to also let you know that if you'd like to find out more about myself or the show, then you can go to bbsradio.com and on the right-hand side, scroll down, have a look at the names of the radio shows and look for Otherwhere with Liz Miller and you'll find me. Click on that link and you'll be taken to my bio page, which will in turn take you to the archives page. And for those of you who aren't aware, there are archives of the last 6 months of shows on the BBS Radio website. So please do check them out. And What was I going to say? That's right. The latest ones have just been posted. Thank you very much, Doug. The other thing is, if you'd like to join the Otherwear Yahoo group, then please go and check out groups.yahoo.com/group/otherwear. And you can email me at any time at otherwearhost@yahoo.com. Thanks so much for listening in, everybody. I hope you have a wonderful remainder of the weekend. No matter where you are in the world, it's been such a pleasure to be with you again this week. And we will be back next week with William Henry. He'll be back to tell us about his recent trip to Egypt. We're going to get into a bit of Egyptology. Oh, that'll be fun. And we're going to talk about the eclipse, which happened in March, that William happened to be a witness of. It was a total solar eclipse, and apparently it was spectacular, lasting for around 4.5 minutes of totality. I'm a little bit envious, I've got to say, but I can't wait to talk to William all about it. And he's going to be telling us about some amazing new discoveries he has made, along with a team from National Geographic. So that's next week on Otherwear. Thanks again for tuning in. We'll see you again in 7 days' time. Bye-bye, y'all.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a Service to Others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning in to our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.